Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Mortgage rates are starting to rise, but where can you get a better deal on your savings? Barclays is fined £7 million for selling cautious funds that made big losses, so which fund names can you trust? And with inflation worries now spreading to emerging markets, are developed markets a more exciting place to be? All this to come on this week's FT Money Show. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with my colleagues from FT Money, Alice Ross.
Hello.
And Steve Lodge.
Hello.
And our special studio guest, Richard Skelt, co-head of investment strategy at Fidelity International.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. This week's announcement of the largest monthly rise in inflation for years, taking the Consumer Prices Index measure up to 3.7%, nearly twice the government target, has led to predictions of rising interest rates. Mortgage time bomb as cheap deals set to disappear, said one newspaper headline this week. Soaring rates on the way, said another. But at this newspaper, we have been wondering when savings rates are going to soar, if at all, after nearly 2 years of rock-bottom returns. At present, many of the best buy savings rates are based on short-term bonuses, which soon expire, leaving savers earning next to nothing. However, there are some signs that building societies may be trying to offer a better deal. Steve, you've been looking at these signs. What are they?
Well, Matthew, people, savers will be will welcome the news, if you like, that some banks and building societies, albeit a minority, are trying to target their existing savers more rather than remaining wholly focused on just dragging in new money. So you mentioned rightly that the bulk of the best buys, best instant access and notice cap best buys out there include these big introductory bonuses, which when they fall off, you're left with a rather less enticing rate. But Leeds Building Society has been writing to thousands of its internet online access savers, telling them that actually, well, we know your introductory bonus is coming to an end, but what we're going to do is going to give you a new bonus. And clearly it's aimed at retaining these funds, because retaining funds is the counterpoint of actually going out into the marketplace and attracting new money, of course.
And this seems quite unusual in that, I think in the past, you know, these bonus rates would just expire and banks and building societies would just keep quiet about it.
It's very unusual. I mean, it's more this kind of attempt to kind of get people to reinvest, or rather not reinvest here, stay with you, is more common, of course, among in the fixed rate market where you have a defined maturity date. But even there, if your provider tells you that your fixed rate has matured, and there's an if there, the new fixed rate offers they typically present to you are no better than those available to new customers. But there are one or two providers, again, who have most recently have been offering extra deals, extra existing saver-only deals, if you like. So, for example, West Bromwich Building Society has been approaching people in the middle of their fixed term and saying, well, actually, if you agree to extend your fixed term beyond the 1 year, then we'll give you an enhanced rate. Or ICICI Bank, the Indian bank, actually specifically gives a 5 basis point bonus, not much, I know, 0.05 in English, on the new rate on the new bond for the existing savers. So they're actually getting a higher rate than the existing savers. But of course, what analysts say about all this is it's all very well to be offered these, if you like, retention deals or these extra deals or loyalty deals, whatever. But you still, of course, have to check whether it's the best in the marketplace. We don't have to, but you may find you can do even better if you shop around. But it may, of course, suit some people who can't be bothered with the switching.
Does this have anything to do with the fact that the rules are changing on the notification of savers about changes to their interest rates?
Well, exactly. I mean, you could take a rather more cynical view of this.
That I was trying to take that.
Well, of course, that it isn't just banks and building societies being nicey-nicey. I mean, of course, they're doing it for commercial reasons. Since last May, banks and building societies have had to write to virtually all savers when any rate has fallen. In simple terms, by a noticeable amount, and that noticeable amount would include when an introductory bonus comes off an account. So they're having to write to them anyway. So having told you that they're about to pay you much less, it just seems logical in some ways to say, "Well, by the way, we're paying you less, but actually, we've just suddenly found some more money in the kitty, and we're going to give you a bit more," in the hope, of course, that you won't leave. Some analysts say that with these Best Buy accounts, when the bonus falls off, there are sufficient numbers of active savers who switch between these accounts out there that the vast majority of savers leave very quickly. So you do have a very active market in that bonus account.
And just very quickly, of any of the sort of retention bonuses that you've seen, I know that we're only talking about a few at the moment, have any of those been Best Buys, or have people still been better off switching?
Well, I think it's West Bromwich Building Society last year had some very good e-bonds that some people may still be in. For example, it had maturing rates last year that were paying 4.3% for 1 year, which was good money. Now you'd be lucky to get 3. Some people were told if they were prepared to extend, say, 6 months, they could get the same rate, which at the time, for the time of the accounts available in that marketplace, was very good. So it's just simply a question of comparing. But it's a further sign of, if you like, this intense competition in savings. And, of course, from a pure consumerist perspective, not all of us can be bothered to switch accounts all the time. Clearly, it's that much more worthwhile with big balances. But if you can't, it means you are getting a less bad deal.
Indeed, it does. And to make it easy for you to compare any kind of bonus rate or retention rate with the Best Buys, Steve has put together an analysis of all of the best rates that are currently available for the money section of this weekend's FT and on our website at ft.com/money. Still to come on the show, where in the world will you find the best investment returns? We try to make sense of some conflicting predictions. First, though, fund names. On Tuesday, the Financial Services Authority imposed its largest ever fine for advice failings when it ordered Barclays to pay £7.7 million plus £59 million in redress to savers who were advised to buy a cautious or balanced income fund. The regulator found that Barclays had failed to ensure that these funds were suitable for customers and that the product brochures properly explained the risks involved. Of the 12,000 or so investors who were advised to buy these so-called cautious funds, most were retired or nearing retirement, and they then saw their apparently cautious investments lose more than 40% in a year. Now, Alice, Barclays has been fined, and we've all seen the stories about that this week, but isn't it time something was done about these misleading fund names?
Well, yes, it is really time that someone did something, because, of course, calling a fund cautious is not by any means limited to Barclays. In this case, it wasn't actually a Barclays fund, it was an Aviva fund that Barclays was selling. So it was the Aviva cautious, the Aviva balanced fund. But this is very, very common. There's a whole sector from the Investment Management Association that is called cautious managed. And so these cautious funds are hugely popular with investors who probably like the idea of committing money to what they see as a cautious fund. But in fact, I'm here with Richard Skelt at Fidelity. And Richard, if you have a cautious fund, that can mean that the fund has up to 60% in equities, doesn't it? Which maybe doesn't sound that cautious.
That is absolutely right. And, I think it, I would agree that it is a problem. I think the problem we've got here is that there's a series of terms or descriptions that are used to describe fund types used by advisors, which were developed in the late 80s, early 90s, and had some resonance then. And, you know, with all sorts of business, there's jargon, there are terms which mean things to specific interest groups. But if you take them outside of that and offer them to the wider population, then there is the possibility that people may not understand the risks that they are taking. Mm. And at that point, really, I think the only way to understand what it is you're buying is to look beneath the label and actually look at the asset allocation, actually what it is that you've got inside the portfolio.
Even that can be quite tricky for your average private investor, can't it? Because while all of these funds have to produce monthly fact sheets and they have to say what they're invested in. So if you really looked at this, you could see that your cautious fund was 60% in equities and you'd see that your balanced fund was 85% in equities. But sometimes they're just not that easy to understand and they're investing in derivatives and all sorts of, you know, relatively complex instruments. And is it fair to expect private investors to understand that, really?
It's a very, very interesting question. And I guess it really comes down to what the alternative is. It is, you know, for those of us who work in this business, either directly or, you know, in types of business which are very closely related to investment management, then, you know, we have an understanding of what 60% in equities actually means in terms of possible portfolio outcomes. And, you know, the fact that a portfolio that has, say, 60% in equities could fall by 30 or 40%, that's not unexpected. You'd have seen the same thing happen between 2001 and 2003, very, very, very likely. So these sort of things are within the practical experience of those people who are active in the market. Quite how you take that experience, which, you know, the professionals have, and then make it available to individuals who may be buying it, particularly if they're going to something like a website, is a very, very tricky question. And I think it's a lot of work needs to be done to be able to spell out to investors, whether private investors, people investing in DC schemes, who are exposed to market risk, that they actually understand the parameters within which the performance can fall.
Mm. But even though there are all of these kind of risk management things put in place to make sure that investors can understand what's in their fund, for example, the monthly fund fact sheets, do you think that nonetheless the name in itself is misleading, calling a fund cautious?
Yeah, I think it's not at all helpful, and it relates back to an era when people had a much more optimistic view on life. You know, in the 1990s, if you look back over the last 15 years, with one exception, you know, the 87 crash, and equities have delivered very, very consistent returns. The experience since 2000 has been very, very different, and, you know, those labels clearly are not appropriate for the current environment.
Mm. But there is some hope on the horizon, I think, because the Investment Management Association told me this week that they're actually revising these fund sectors, cautious managed, balanced managed, and also Absolute Return, which is another hugely misleading fund name. Matthew, I think you were speaking to the IMA.
Yes, I had lunch with the chief executive and said, get on with this process of reviewing the sectors and giving them better names. And he said, message received and understood. I'll get back to the membership, but it's still going to take, I think, till the end of the year.
Mm, and they started in August last year.
So I know, how long do you need?
Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, my point is surely it should be the regulator, not the marketing association of the fund management industry that decides on a new anemic title. You know, and I've got a bugbear with cash funds as well. The number of, I mean, what do you call your cash fund at Fidelity? Do you call it cash, Fidelity Cash?
Well, we've a range of them, but cash is, if it is a true cash fund.
Well, this is the question, isn't it?
Which is, you know, has a NAV that's not going to go down, then typically we would call that cash. For a product which does not have NAV certainty, then that would not be called cash under our internal procedures.
I mean, this has been a big problem, hasn't it? A big problem in the States that
well, big funds here with Standard Life.
Well, indeed, that funds haven't proved to be capital secure, even though they've been described as cash or cash-like, whether or not Fidelity or others. Certainly some fund managers have indeed described them as exactly that, and some advisors have.
Exactly. I think something must be done and can be done right now. So we'll keep campaigning for this. But for now, Richard, thank you very much for that. And if you'd like to know more about the sort of question marks surrounding not just cautious, but as Alice mentioned, absolute return fund names and definitions, you can read Alice's cautionary tale in the money section of this weekend's FT and on the website ft.com/money. And finally today, global equities. After a strong period of stock market gains in 2010, many investors will be wondering where the best place to put their money will be this year. And if fund sales figures are anything to go by, most private investors are backing global emerging markets. But emerging markets are looking increasingly susceptible to inflation, with fears rising that local governments will start to raise interest rates, which would curb the returns that foreign investors could get. So some global equity fund managers instead think that developed markets, which have been out of fashion since the credit crunch, will be the areas that will grow most this year, with many shifting their portfolios towards the US. Alice, we receive some note about an emerging markets fund almost every day now. Why do you think people are now turning back from emerging markets to somewhere as traditional and developed as the US?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with valuation. I don't really think that anyone is now saying emerging markets are no longer going to grow loads in the future. We know that this is, you know, there's this huge population boom in emerging markets. Far more people are moving into the middle class, so they're, you know, consuming a lot more and they're starting to spend on luxury goods. So all of this is definitely going to contribute to long-term growth. What people are saying right now is that this year, emerging markets have had this amazing recovery since the credit crunch. They've risen absolutely loads. So people are saying this year they may not rise as much as some other places will just on a kind of short-term basis. So then looking around where might rise more than it's grown previously, the US is looking good because of, the US, of course, has been massively out of favour since the credit crunch. It wasn't growing at all. Its economy looked like it was in a shambles. But now with the Fed taking moves towards, you know, it did a second round of quantitative easing a few months ago, which, you know, seems to be going well, people are actually saying some US companies are massively underrated and they look like they could be a bargain.
You mentioned valuation being one of the factors that's encouraging people to look at the US again. Sort of in historical terms or on, you know, sort of fundamental metrics, what sort of valuations are we talking about?
Well, if you take some companies, for example, Microsoft is currently on a price earnings ratio of about 12. Now, if you compare that to one of its competitors, Salesforce.com, that's currently on a price earnings ratio of 150. Which is just insane.
Which sounds, yes, yeah, somewhat overvalued.
Yeah, but it's just been hugely popular recently. But everyone's meanwhile ignored Microsoft because, you know, Apple is kind of much more trendy at the moment. But people are starting to say, well, come on, Microsoft is going to grow more than that. So this is a cheap price to buy it at.
Certainly. And just to come back to the other point you were making about the consumption habits of those in emerging markets, is there a case that Western developed market exporters producing the cars and luxury goods that people in emerging markets want to buy will also be attractive equity holdings?
Yeah, that's definitely being recommended as a good way to get to the emerging market exposure right now, because that way you're still tapping into whatever consumer growth there will be in emerging markets, but you're doing it in a safer way that hopefully takes away some of the risk of local governments in the emerging markets, you know, messing around with inflation and interest rates there. So big multinational companies, often those in the consumer space that are maybe selling luxury handbags, or it tends to not be that things that you need, like milk and groceries and things like that. There's actually this report out this week from Credit Suisse showing that even wealthy consumers in emerging markets still buy domestic brands for those kind of things. But there is this kind of aspirational thing for luxury items where they would prefer to buy Western brands. So in that case, you're onto a winner buying those kind of companies.
And just lastly, you talked about fund managers are now shifting emphasis towards developed markets. Are there any particular funds started to do this that you'd single out?
There are quite a few fund managers I've spoken to. I mean, in a way, so many people are talking about the US, you almost wonder if you shouldn't, you know, on a kind of contrarian approach, invest in the US. But I was just speaking to John Chatfield Roberts this morning at Jupiter. He says he's now more overweight in the US than he's ever been. Then I was talking to Treetop Asset Management. They're also overweight in the US. I was talking to Schroders, also overweight in the US.
I think, though, isn't the danger, though, Alice, if you invest abroad, what you gain on the stock market in the USA, you lose on the currency? I mean, I think this is an issue for Brits this year, that we might see sterling strength. And the result of that is obviously the local currency weakness. Mm. So what you gain on the market, as I say, you lose on the currency, in which case that would be an argument for staying at home.
It is. But if you buy into a global equity fund, you can usually rely on the fund manager to hedge some of that currency exposure because they're aware that most of their investors are based in the UK. So that is definitely a concern. But if you are buying into one of these global funds, usually they'll sort that out for you.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Alice. And for more on the relative merits and valuations of global markets, look out for Alice's feature in the money section of this weekend's FT. But that's all for this week's FT Money Show. Remember, you will find weekday news updates and all of these stories on our website, ft.com/money. And if you have a question that you would like us to answer about any aspect of your finances, just email us. The address is money@ft.com. Next week, we'll bring you another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from Steve, Alice, and our special guest, Richard Skelt from Fidelity.
Goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.